All right, I would like to welcome those who are listening to the podcast. We are on lesson number 4 in a series entitled Mind the Gap, where we are looking at the time period between the close of the Hebrew Scriptures and the opening of the New Testament Scriptures. Now, this is a 12 to 14 week series, and we're only on lesson 4, and we have not yet quite come to the gap period. Tonight, we're just beginning to encroach that time period that runs from 400 BC, 400 years before Christ, to the birth of Jesus Christ. That's the gap time period. It's about 400 years. So when you read the Hebrew Scriptures, what you call the Old Testament, and you come to the last book of the English Old Testament, the book of Malachi, and it closes with a statement about the coming of the Messiah and his forerunner, John the Baptist. Then you go to your very next book, which is the book of Matthew, and it opens with the story of the genealogy of Jesus and John the Baptist preaching in the wilderness. It seems as if it's all connected, but there's 400 years that have passed. And as I explained in lesson number 2, Jews today who read the Scriptures, their Scriptures, the Hebrew Scriptures, it's the same Scriptures as you read, what you call the Old Testament, but they would never call it the Old Testament. They just call it their Scriptures. And the order is different. The last book of their Scriptures is the book of 2 Chronicles. And frankly, if I had money to publish a book, I would republish the Bible and structure it the way the Jews structure their Scriptures, because there's some beautiful continuity in the Hebrew Scriptures compared to your New Testament Scriptures. I don't have time to go over all of that tonight, but the early Christians, the early church fathers who followed the Lord Jesus, they accepted the order of the Hebrew Scriptures. And the reason they chose 27 New Testament books is because they wanted the total scrolls or the total books of God's Word to be 49. And so the Jews had their Scriptures and we have ours. Well, that's another time, another story, another study. Tonight, what I want to do is continue on in our timeline. Last week, I gave you an overview of Hebrew history. And now we are coming to the beginning of what is called the Persian Empire. And I want to begin tonight by just giving you 5 things to know about the Persian Empire. Now, you're going to have your notes in front of you this evening, and if you are listening online, we've had a few calls already to the office because you wanted to know where you could get the notes. We will send them to you free of charge. Give us your email address. We'll forward them to you digitally. Our desire and our hope next year, beginning in 2020, is for our study on Wednesday night to be a little bit more friendly for people who listen to it. In fact, we want to do it on video. We want to do it live. We want to archive it. And we want you to have the ability to follow along on the notes if you're listening. And so we're working on that. That's something we wish to do, but that's in the Lord's hands. And we're going to try to make it easier for you by January of 2020. But having said that, if you have notes before you tonight, what you might want to do is not even attempt to follow me on the notes, because I've just gone back through again and read everything I've given to you, and everything that's printed will be spoken orally, but in a little bit different order. And what I'll be showing you on the screen will facilitate what I'll be saying. So I've given you these notes so that you can take them home and they can refresh your memory, what you're hearing tonight. But you really need to listen more than any other lesson tonight, because I've got to cover a lot of ground. 5 things to know about the Persian Empire. First, the Persians are often mentioned in the Hebrew Scriptures. Often. In fact, this goes to your salmon-colored handout, appendix number 4, I have listed for you all of the places in the Hebrew Scriptures where the Persians are mentioned. And also, in lesson number 4, in the first paragraph, I've given you several references from the Hebrew Scriptures. But tonight, what I want to do is show you that the Persians you read about in the Hebrew Scriptures are what we would call modern-day Iranians. Now, they're Persians. They live in Iran. Some of them live in Turkey. Some of them live in Iraq. So they're scattered a little bit like Americans that may live in other countries, but their home base is Iran. So when we speak of Iranians, we're talking about biblical Persians. Now they're also known by another name about 200 years after the birth of Christ. They're called the Parthians. And there's a reason for that that I won't get into. But I just want you to understand, as we talk tonight about the Persians, we're talking about people who live in Iran. Now, here's another thing. We are not discussing tonight Muslims. In fact, Persians who live in Iran today are not Muslim. They're not Arab. Now, their government leaders have converted to Islam. And some of them have an Arab heritage. But the average Persian today in Iran submits to Islam because they're ordered to by the government. And that's one of the reasons why the CIA in the 1970s and 1980s sought to bring about a revolt in Iran. They believed the Persian people would throw off the radical Islamic Republic of Ayatollah Khomeini. Okay, so you understand that. Now, what is the religion of Persians? Well, back in Old Testament days, it was Astrozoroastrianism. You say, oh my word, what is that? Well, basically, they worship the stars. There's a lot of things I could say about it, but they worship the stars. And they believed in one God. They believed in judgment after death, and I believe that many of the Hebrews, because of their contact with the Persians, they were influenced by the theology of the Persians. Now, that's not to say that the Old Testament is not inspired by God. For heaven's sake, of course it is. But you've got to understand, the Hebrews mingled with the Persians for a long time. Here's a map showing you Iran. We call it today the Middle East. And I know if you're listening to the podcast, you're not able to see the map. I would encourage you to pull up Google and just do a search, Middle East map, and take a look at where Iran is. This is ancient Persia. And then Iraq is to the west. Pakistan is to the east. Saudi Arabia is to the south and to the west across the Persian Gulf. And of course, Israel is further to the west on the coast of the Mediterranean. Now, the Persian people, as I've shared with you in your handout under Roman numeral 1, originate in Russia. They are Indo-Aryan. After Noah landed the ark, you can trace the Indo-Aryans, the Persian people, as they scattered to the north. But by the 8th century BC, 800 years before Christ, two tribes of the Indo-Aryans of Russia, the Medes, M-E-D-E-S, and the Perusa, or Persians, crossed the mountains that were in southwestern Russia and moved into what we call the Middle East. And so sometimes I will use the term Medes and Persians, and sometimes you'll hear it Medes and Persians. But let me illustrate who those two tribes are. It would be like us saying Americans and Canadians. They're cousins. They're tribes from the same family. And so on. And they came together. Though they would end up fighting one another, they came together and settled in what we call the Middle East in the 8th century. And this is the beginning of what we call the Persians. Now, What you've got to understand about Persia, and here's another map. This is where Iran is today. They began to grow in power. And as they grew in power, Babylon subjected them, like Babylon subjected all of the tribes in the area. Because remember, Babylon is the world's second empire. Babylon had conquered Assyria, and now Babylon has conquered all the tribes that live in the region. And so Babylon is really, if you will, the world leader of its day. And as we saw last week, the Jews were conquered by the wicked king Nebuchadnezzar, who gouged the eyes of the Jews' last king, Zedekiah. Gouged his eyes out. The last things that King Zedekiah saw were his sons being butchered by Nebuchadnezzar. And they gouged his eyes out, put him in chains, and transported him to Babylon, because the Babylonians were wicked people. They didn't like foreign women. They forced them to marry other foreign men from other nations. They subjugated all of the smartest and brightest people from the lands they conquered and brought them as prisoners to Babylon. And the kings of those countries they conquered, they humiliated, including Zedekiah. But what happens is the Persian people begin to revolt. And it's almost like a miracle in that the Persian Empire conquers the Babylonian Empire. And listen to this. This is really cool. Exactly 70 years after Babylon first became an empire. Babylon only lasted 70 years as an empire. Persia conquered them. And there are 10 kings in the ancient Persian Empire. And tonight, I'm only going to tell you about three of them, but all 10 are listed on page 1 of lesson number 4. And I will be going through these 10 kings. They're listed here on the screen as well. The first one you need to know about is Cyrus the Great. He is the first king of kings of the Persian Empire. Now, he's not the first leader of the Persian people. They've already been in existence. But he's the one who conquered the Babylonians. And it's a little interesting tidbit. He is Cyrus the Second, but you know him as Cyrus the Great. He's named after his grandfather, and it's kind of cool. This ancient tradition of naming your son after your father, meaning grandfathers would have the same name as their grandsons, carried over to America when we were a first country. Getting started. And in my family, it's a tradition, now maybe not in yours, but grandsons are named after their grandfathers. Well, that's exactly what they did in ancient Persia. So he's Cyrus II because his grandfather was Cyrus, leader of the Persians. But we know Cyrus II as Cyrus the Great, and he is the one that we're going to begin talking about tonight. If you ever go to Iran today, you can visit his tomb. He is a revered leader, even today, in Iran. But he's not only revered in Iran. When you go to West Point, and I just finished yesterday a letter of recommendation for a member of our church, Luke Wells, to our senators, both Senator Inhofe and Senator Langford, recommending Luke's congressional appointment to West Point. Yeah, and it'd be really cool. I think he could get it. But if you go to West Point, you study Cyrus the Great. He is considered, along with Alexander the Great, who we'll talk about next week, the Greek leader. Cyrus the Great, the Persian leader, is considered the world's greatest military leader in our history. So all generals who graduate from West Point study Cyrus the Great. Now, why do they do that? Because it truly was a miracle that he was able to conquer the Babylonians, because the Babylonians were fierce, wicked people. Now, this is also in Iran. And these are the tombs of four other kings of Persia on your list of 10 kings. And I'll tell you, if you're friends of mine on Facebook, and I hope you are, but if you're not, you may be out of luck, Because a church member told me they tried to befriend me the other day, and I've reached my limit, Roy, of 5,000 friends. And Facebook will not let you have any more friends. But this is my profile picture, or has been in the past. This is in Iran. This is on my bucket list. I want to see this. Xerxes is buried in the center right here. Xerxes is the husband of Queen Esther in your Bible. Darius is buried right here. Darius is the father of Xerxes. You can follow along on page one as I give you their names. And these are two later Persian kings. But this is a World Heritage Site that you can still see today. This is Cyrus, Cyrus the Great. And let's go back and remind you. They're laughing in here because I've got a picture of Cyrus and President Donald Trump side by side. And I do that intentionally. I do that intentionally. I want you to listen carefully. The Jews today, the Israelis, they consider Donald Trump the new Cyrus. Israel today has renamed the Golan Heights after Donald Trump. Yeah. So, I know America's split over our president, but I can tell you there's an entire country that loves our president, and that is the nation of Israel. In fact, the Sanhedrin, the official religious body of the Jews today, based in Jerusalem, just issued a coin. And I bought three of them, Tim, and I wanted to show them to you tonight. I cannot find them. It makes me... Oh, Rochelle, did you hear that? I'm so sorry. I cannot find them. Here they are. It's the temple coin. You've got Donald Trump's profile with Cyrus's profile right behind him. And you know what? They do look a little bit alike. Except Donald Trump doesn't have a helmet. No, that's his hair, isn't it? Okay, there's the... That's kind of like. Fourth, the Jews live in peace and prosperity under Persian rule in the province named Judea. During the entire tenure of the Persian Empire, which runs from about 539 to about 329, I've put 333 on your handout. There are wars there between Greece and Persia from 333 to 329, between Alexander the Great and Darius III, and I'll explain to you why they went to war in a moment. For those 230-odd years, the Jews are living at peace. They're rebuilding their country, rebuilding Jerusalem, because Babylon destroyed the city and took the Jews into captivity. So for about 230 years, they live in peace under Persian rule. Are you with me? This is the beginning of the time period between the Testaments. And one of the things that the Persian kings did, beginning with Darius after the death of Cyrus, is they built what's called the Royal Road. It eventually connected to China and became known as the Silk Road. And this is the first major road that went from one country to the next, over the cross, over and across an entire empire, from Iran all the way to modern-day Turkey. And I'm telling you, it was a magnificent feat of architecture. And every few miles, you would have another stable of horses, and some writers, and word from the King of Kings who lived in Persepolis, Iran, Persia, would spread over the empire on the Royal Road. And what's fascinating is this, when you read the book of Esther, a decree went out from the king that the Jews were to be allowed to live. Haman, who had plotted to have them destroyed, he was exposed. For the wicked man he was, and Xerxes sent out an order, rescind the decree to kill the Jews. And the Bible says, and he sent out messengers on steeds and stallions on the royal road. So even in the book of Esther, you read about this royal road. On my bucket list, we have a businessman in our church who has an investment newsletter about China. And he and I have talked about one day taking a trip along the Silk Road, going from China all the way to Istanbul on the ancient road. I would be in hog heaven to do that. But I broached the subject with my wife, and she said, "Wade, for heaven's sake, you can't even travel in Mexico without getting in trouble. How could you ever do it in Iran?" So she has nixed that. Alexander the Great brings an end to the Persian Empire. All I need you to know about tonight is this. The Persian Empire begins in 539 BC with Cyrus the Great conquering Babylon and putting to death the wicked Babylonian king Belshazzar. And you can read about this in Daniel chapter 5. I read it for you last week. But I want to show you that by the time the empire reached its greatest extent in terms of north, south, east, west, it was even bigger than the Babylonian Empire. This was a huge territory governed by the king of Persia. Let's begin. October the 12th, 539 BC. We know the exact date. We know this because of historians who wrote about it, not even the scriptures, although you can read about it in Daniel chapter 5. We know because Greek historians and others told us when it occurred. And it happened in this city, ancient Babylon. All the Jews that you know and love, who lived in Jerusalem, who worshiped Yahweh, when they were captured by Nebuchadnezzar, men like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, other rulers, other prophets, other princes of Judah, were taken to this city, and they were forced to build the walls, one of the greatest wonders of the ancient world, walls wide enough for two chariots to run side by side, the gates, which in the dialect of Babylon, Chaldean, Nebuchadnezzar called them impenetrable gates and walls. The Babylonians believed themselves to be secure from anyone who wanted to attack. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon, again, two of the seven ancient wonders in this great city in the 6th century BC. Wealth, prosperity, buildings built on the back of slaves, including Jews and other nationalities, captured by Nebuchadnezzar, Nabopolassar, Belshazzar, and others. Okay? And then in October of 539 BC, this little Persian army, under the lead of Cyrus, says, "We're going to take Babylon." By the way, when you read Isaiah and Jeremiah, the prophets who are speaking to the Jews who've been captured or will be captured, who will be going to Babylon. Isaiah wrote about 150 years before Jeremiah. He refers to Cyrus by name. I'll show you this in just a moment. Jeremiah refers to him. He is the Lord's anointed. He's the Lord's Messiah. He's being raised up to free God's people from Babylon. And in Daniel 5, as I showed you last week, the handwriting came on the wall when the king of Babylon on October the 12th, 539, was having a great drunken orgy with all of his generals inside the walls of Babylon. And God's hand appeared and said, "Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin." Daniel is called. And Daniel says, "O king, your life will be required of you tonight because your wickedness has been weighed in the scales of God's justice and you've been found wanting." What Belshazzar didn't know, the king of Babylon, what he didn't know is while he was getting drunk with his men for over 2 weeks, the Persians were outside the walls rerouting the Euphrates River that ran underneath the walls of Babylon. that watered the hanging gardens of Babylon. They were rerouting it, damming it up, so that they could march underneath the walls in the muddy riverbed. And that very night, we know this because of Herodotus, the Greek historian, and others, Cyrus marches in and conquers Babylon. Isaiah, 150 years before this happened, wrote in Isaiah 45, verse 1, this is what the Lord says to his anointed. The word anointed there in the Hebrew is the word Messiah. He says this to Cyrus. Notice, Isaiah names Cyrus. By the way, this is why, Roy, I have no problem believing that the Scriptures are God's Word. None. And most atheists and agnostics out there who try to dispute the Word of God, they've never really studied it. They don't know history. They don't know chronology. They don't know Isaiah is writing 150 years before Cyrus is even born. To Cyrus, I say, whose right hand I take hold of, to subdue the nations before him, to strip kings of their armor, to open doors before him so that no gates will be shut before him. I will go before you, Cyrus. I will level the mountains. I will break down the gates of bronze, and I will cut through the bars of iron. I will give you the treasures of darkness and the riches of hidden that are hidden in secret places, so that you may know that I am Yahweh, the God of Israel. And I love this last line, Isaiah 45, verse 3, who calls you by name. Anybody who says that God is only interested in the Jews in the Old Testament hasn't read the Old Testament, because Cyrus is Persian, a Gentile, an Indo-Aryan, and God calls him by name. It's one of the reasons I love Isaiah. As Dr. Darnell says, it's the first gospel. God is the God of the world, not just the Jews. On that night, October the 12th, the Persian army came in and conquered Babylon. And the walls that Nebuchadnezzar said were impenetrable were eventually excavated by the British about 100 years ago. And now you can go see these walls. These are the actual walls of Babylon. You can see them in the British Museum. This is history. Now, I close my story of Cyrus conquering the Babylonian Empire and the beginning of the Persian Empire by just asking you to remember the date, 539 BC. And I understand that dates are sometimes hard. Things get clouded in your mind and all that. But here's the thing. If you can just remember 539 BC, you remember when the Babylonian Empire comes to an end and when the Persian Empire begins. And you also can remember when the Babylonian Empire began, because the Babylonian Empire only lasted 70 years. It began in 609 BC. So 539 is a key date to remember. Now, the Persian Empire, as I said, lasts from October 539 to 329 BC. And again, we'll talk about why it could be 333, 331, 330, 329, but I like 329 and 333. It lasts for about 230 years. And as I shared with you last week, when Cyrus conquered Babylon, he released all the people who were captive in the city, including the Jews. And that's why the Jews love Cyrus, because he let them go home. He let them go home under Zerubbabel to rebuild the temple, under Ezra to reinstitute religion to Yahweh. And by the way, Cyrus, King of Kings, that's what they called him in Persia, said to Ezra and others, hey, listen, when you build the temple, make a sacrifice to Cyrus, or for Cyrus and his family, to your God Yahweh, that Yahweh may bless him. He said this, by the way, to all the countries that he released. And this is the actual document written in the language of Cyrus and formed by the hand of a scribe that is also on display in the British Museum. Cyrus is loved by people, even today, because he's a military genius. He honored the local customs and religions of the people that the Babylonians had destroyed and captured and subjugated. He released them and said, we honor your religion. Go home, build a temple, and make a sacrifice for me. And he allowed the Jews to return to Jerusalem, and they rebuilt their city and their temple. Zerubbabel, the temple, Ezra reinstituted the religion, and Nehemiah rebuilt the walls. And you read about this in Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay? Now, Cyrus met his death on the battlefield. And it's quite interesting that a woman had him killed. A woman leader of a country he was attempting to conquer. And her soldiers killed Cyrus. Who had Cyrus killed her son? And she asked for his head. And they bring Cyrus's head, and she dips it in a vat of blood and holds it up and mocks Cyrus. Now, again, we know this from Herodotus, but the reason I tell you that is this. All the riches in life, all the power in life, you can be called king of kings, you can rule the world, you know. Let me tell you something. In the end, everyone dies, including Cyrus. So, who took over? Well, Cambyses did. And you're laughing because you see the cats. I'm going to tell you about the cats in just a moment. Cambyses took over. Cambyses, his son, took over for about 7 years. And again, he's named after his grandfather, the father of Cyrus. Okay, he took over for 7 years as king of Persia. I'm not going to talk a lot about him, but he did one thing, and he did one thing really well. He expanded the Persian Empire by conquering Egypt. And does anybody know how he conquered Egypt? Okay, good. I'm telling you something you don't know. The soldiers, the Persian soldiers, took cats. Because the ancient Egyptians believed that cats were holy and sacred. And so they would never approach anyone with a cat. They took tens of thousands of cats. And they took Egypt because the Egyptians wouldn't fight with the cats present. Isn't that crazy? It's a little bit like, and forgive me, I went to India one time, and we were driving around, and you know, and the guide was saying, oh man, there's so much poverty, people don't have food to eat, everybody's sick because they don't have any nutrition, and I'm looking around, and there are cows everywhere. Just kill a cow. Why won't they kill a cow? The cow is sacred. Isn't it amazing how religion will just mess you up? By the way, I wouldn't touch anybody with a cat either. So. Okay, so this is Cambyses. He takes Egypt. He spreads. He spreads the Persian Empire. Okay, good night. We've got to move quickly. The royal road is built by the next king of Persia, Darius. By the way, here's what's interesting. I don't have time to tell you how all of the 10 kings of ancient Persia met their death, but except for Cyrus, who died on the battlefield, and one other exception, Darius III, who is killed by Alexander the Great, and we'll get to that next week, every other king of Persia is murdered by his own family. Yeah. Another little tidbit. If you've ever been in a family that has argued over money and inheritance and who gets what, let me tell you, nothing ever changes. We're just repeating what's happened since 700 years before Christ, or 500 in case of the Persians. You need to know about Darius because of the war that began during his reign with the Greeks. Now we are moving into a time period between the Testaments where you will not know what I'm about to tell you because you read the Bible. You will know this because of events that take place between the Testaments and are written about by historians other than biblical historians. Now, I cannot tell you how critically important what I'm about to tell you is in your understanding of the Bible. Because you will only comprehend the world of Jesus, which is Greek, when you recognize how the Greeks came to power. And you won't know how the Greeks came to power until you understand the wars that occurred between the Persians and the people of Greece. So, let me talk about these wars. They're called the Persian Wars, and they're with Greece. Now, I want to give you some perspective. What caused these wars? Well, if you're an empire that rules over the known world, I want to ask you a question. How are you going to pay for the roads that you're building? How are you going to pay for the chariots you need, the horses you need? How are you going to pay for the city walls? How are you going to pay for everything? Anybody? That's right. Keep conquering and what? Taxes. It's taxes. So, Persia goes into Ionia. Ionia is what we call modern Turkey. And I'm going to show you a map here in just a moment. You'll get a visual. And they conquer them, the Ionians. And then they start raising the taxes. Well, what they didn't realize at the time was that many of the people who lived in Ionia or Turkey came from Greece. And so I'm going to put it in simple language that we'll all understand. Some of the conquered Ionians who are now paying taxes to the Persians wrote letters back home to Athens and said, "This is not good." So guess what? That's right. The people in Athens and Greece said, "Okay, you know what? If you revolt, we're going to help you. You can either come home or we'll go to war." And they said, "Well, we're going to fight. We're not going to leave Ionia." And so the Greeks sent some soldiers to help the Ionians fight against the Persians. And it enraged Darius, who is called Darius the Great. And here's a picture of it. Here's Ionia. A few years ago, did anybody go with us on the cruise over the Mediterranean? Yeah, William, I saw you. You were with us. We went to Samos. We went to ancient Ionia, which is now Turkey. Here is Ionia on the map. Look how close. Look how close Greece is. I mean, there's Athens right there. It's right there. So we're not talking, it's just right here. Now, if I were to show you Persia on this map, man, we'd have to extend the map way out here. Out here, because the Persians have come a long way to conquer Ionia. And the Greeks, they come in, and you know what? They attack and they destroy a Persian stronghold. Darius hears about it because messengers go on the royal road and tell him, and he is so absolutely angry. He puts an army together and he says, "We are going to go teach those stupid Greeks a lesson." And so he marches his army and takes some by ship. And the year is now 490 BC, and they come to a plain in Greece called Marathon. And the Battle of Marathon takes place. The Battle of Marathon, September the 12th. By the way, today's the 11th. The anniversary of the Battle of Marathon is tomorrow. 490 BC. Now, I want you to get in your mind something. The Athenians. Greece at this time is not a country even. It's not an empire. It's polis, or city-states. It's individual cities. You've got Athens. You've got Thessaloniki. You've got different cities, and they self-govern. You've got Sparta to the south. Sometimes the Greeks and the Spartans go to war with each other, but most of the time they're allies. So you've got these cities, Corinth. So they're called Corinthians and Athenians and Spartans and Thessalonians and so on. Well, they're not soldiers. They're just citizens like me and you, farmers. Okay? So word is coming that Darius and the mighty Persians are coming to extract a price for the Greeks defending the Ionians and having the gall to come to Ionia and attack us. And so everybody in Greece is scared to death. Herodotus says 2.6 million soldiers came. But I'm jumping ahead to the next battle. But he gets his numbers wrong. I don't know what Herodotus says on the Marathon battle. He's the Greek historian from a long time ago. But most modern historians say 10,000 Athenians met 25,000 Persian soldiers at Marathon. And The Greeks did something that the Persians had never seen. They formed a phalanx. It's a military maneuver where you have shields like this to protect yourself from Persian arrows that were coming from the lightly armored archers of Persia. You had shields, and then you had long swords that were out in front of you and up like this. And you move like that. And the Persians never seen anything like it. And by the way, the guy who invented this is still studied this day for military tactics at West Point. And lo and behold, at the Battle of Marathon, Greece won. They couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe it. In fact, they had sent a runner by the name of Pheidippides to Sparta. And here is a map showing you how far he had to run. He had to run all this way when they heard that Persia was coming to ask Sparta for help. And the Spartans, who were tough, tough soldiers, brutes of men, said, "We'll help, but we got to wait 2 weeks because we're in the middle of a festival." No joke. So Sparta runs all the way back to Athens and gives word, "The Spartans aren't coming, we're on our own." And the Greeks win. And some say it's a legend, but there's got to be some truth to it. When the Battle of Marathon was over, and it lasted about, I think, 7 days. It was several days. And the Greeks unexpectedly won. They sent Pheidippides running back to Athens to tell the people of Athens that, lo and behold, Greece is saved. And when he brings the message to Athens, to the center of the city, he falls over dead of a heart attack. Do you know how far it is from Marathon to Athens? 26.2 miles. This is why modern day marathons are 26.2 miles, and this is why it's called Marathon, because it's from Marathon to Athens. So when the modern Olympics opened in 1896 in Athens, Greece, the marathon was run from Marathon to the stadium in Athens, which is 26.2 miles away. Make sense? Okay, now, we're almost done. Darius unexpectedly dies. So his son comes to the throne, Xerxes the First. And this is the last king I'm going to tell you about before we just quickly go through the remaining kings of the Persian Empire, and I give you just a taste of what's coming next week. Xerxes, the son of Darius, comes to the throne. Now, I remind you, this is the Xerxes that marries Esther. This is the Xerxes of the book of Esther. And the full list of titles that he took was this: King of Persia and Media, Great King, King of Kings, Sahesahan is the way you say it, King of Nations or of the World, and Pharaoh of Egypt. And lo and behold, when he comes to the throne, and it's in your notes in 486, that's when his dad unexpectedly died, murdered. Xerxes comes to the throne and he reigns for 21 years. And in 480, he decides to take revenge on the Greeks for the Battle of Marathon in 490. They humiliated his dad, and he's going to make it right. So this is where Herodotus says that Xerxes takes 2.6 million soldiers. I don't think that's right. I think it's more like 200,000 soldiers plus attendants. And he marches them from Persia, which is, again, way off the map. It's a long march. He marches them right up here to Ionia, and he's got to cross the Aegean Sea. But to get there, he's got to march his army on land to the north and send ships across the Aegean. So he has to build a bridge across what's called the Dardanelles, which is the closest land point in the western portion of Turkey. Basically, it's the connection between the east and the west. And he built a pontoon bridge with his soldiers. And while his soldiers were attempting to cross, a storm came up that so infuriated Xerxes because the pontoon bridge broke apart, he did two things. He killed the men who built the bridge that broke apart. Then he took a whip and he began whipping the sea as King of Kings, cursing the sea. Can you believe that? This is the kind of guy that he was. This is where he crossed. This is a drawing of him whipping the sea as if he's God. He marches his army, crosses this point, marches his army to the north, coming to meet the Athenians and the Spartans, who this time said, "We'll be there for you." He comes to meet them in a battle, and the ships sail the Aegean, the Persian ships. So they're going to attack from the sea, and they're going to attack from land. Correct. So let me briefly tell you about this battle, and we'll be done. Because I'll say to you, the reason you need to understand why this is important, had Xerxes won, you would be speaking Farsi tonight, not English. Had Xerxes won, the West, as we know it, would truly be the East. Because this was the determining battle between East and West. Whoever wins this battle determines the course of the world for the next 2,000 years. And because the Greeks eventually win, Alexander the Great comes onto the scene a century later and decides to punish the Persians, and he marches to Persia. And it's an incredible story of how the East becomes Greek for the coming of the Messiah. But let me tell you about this battle in 480. It's called the Battle of Thermopylae. And if you want to see a movie, it's rated R, and there's some bad scenes in it. I would not have children around, but it's a pretty good historical representation. It's called 300, and it was made about 10 years ago. Leonidas and 300 Spartans came to help the Greeks. They were wildly outnumbered. But the only way that the Persian army could get to Athens was to go through a mountain pass at Thermopylae. Now, the Grecian army met the Persians out in front of the pass, but they were wiped out. All that was left was 300 Spartans under the leadership of Leonidas and a few Thespians. These are men from Thespia, Greece. And they are blocking the mountain pass. And they fight to the death. What's interesting, Sparta is to the south of Athens. You've heard the phrase, he's Spartan. Have you heard that? What does that mean? It means he's disciplined. He works hard. He can live on little. That's Spartan. It comes from Sparta. When a Spartan mother gives her son over to be a soldier, by handing him his shield and his sword, she will say to him, "With it, or on it," meaning you win with it or you die on it. You will not be captured. So at the Battle of Thermopylae, all 300 Spartans lose their lives. And today, anything that you see in Athens is not older than 480 BC. Because when Xerxes and his men broke through the mountain pass, they got to Athens and they wiped everything to the ground, like Nebuchadnezzar did to Jerusalem in 586 BC. Xerxes did that to Athens. It's gone, burned to the ground. And this is what so infuriated Alexander the Great 130 years later, why he went with his army to defeat the Persians and to kill the king himself. He refused to let any soldier kill Darius III. He was going to do it in retaliation for the Persians burning Athens. There's a monument at Thermopylae. Oh, I don't think I have it. It's a poem. And I think I can quote it. And it goes something like this. "O stranger, as you walk by, tell the people of Sparta, here we lie. Fully obedient to our laws, we died to ensure the safety of our brothers. And when we were there, I was able to see that monument. It's an incredible history. Now, I got 2 minutes. Here we go. Xerxes burns Athens, then he brings his throne out to the coast to watch the naval battle. Now remember, the Greeks have already been wiped out. But what Xerxes didn't know is that before the Persian army and navy arrived, a great leader of Athens had gone up to Delphi, to the oracle, and he had asked the oracle at Delphi, the Persians are coming, what should we do? And let me tell you, this is Rochelle and me at the oracle of Delphi. I'm not joking. I know I exaggerate. I'm not exaggerating here, I promise. Most beautiful spot I've ever seen in the world. The oracle of Delphi was a woman who would sit on a rock or a chair beside a rock where gases would flow. And it was capped. She would take the cap off. A question would be asked of her. Ask of the gods. And the oracle, a young woman, would sniff the gas and would go like this. And then she would give an answer in the form of poetry. And what she said to the great leader of Athens when he asked, the Persians are coming, what do we do? The oracle of Delphi said, flee Athens, hide behind a wall of wood on the island of Salamis. So for the months leading up to the Persian navy coming to Athens, the Greeks were building ships and hiding them in the harbor of Salamis. So in the greatest naval battle in the history of the world, called the Naval Battle of Salamis, the Greeks were hiding in their trireme ships. The Persians are coming. The sun is blinding the Persians in their boats. They can't see. And then all of a sudden, word is given, and the Greeks come racing out of the harbor, and they ram the Persian ships. And they defeat the mighty Persian navy. And they save Greece. Xerxes is watching this take place on his throne on the shore of the Aegean. And he stands up mortified. He can't believe it. How are they going to get back? Are they going to have to march? His ships are destroyed. So he withdraws from Greece in a rage, makes his way all the way back to Persia, walking. And it is said, for the next 200 years, people who lived on the island of Salamis never had to tear down trees for firewood. They would go to the beach and they would pick up wood to burn it in their homes. So, now you know why. After the death of Xerxes, who himself was also murdered, Artaxerxes comes to the throne. Then Darius II, who's the grandson of Darius, then Artaxerxes II, who is grandson of Artaxerxes I, then Artaxerxes III, then Arses, then Darius III. Darius III is killed by Alexander the Great because he's infuriated with what Xerxes did to Athens. And next week we will talk about the rise of Alexander the Great, how he moved from Greece east. And Alexander the Great's story is incredible. In fact, I'll just give you a little teaser. When Alexander came to Judea, he was upset with the Jews because they had sided with Persia all along. And he was ready to wipe out the Jews until the high priest comes out from the temple, and this is according to Josephus and Herodotus both, and he meets Alexander and does something that changes the mind of Alexander about the Jews. And to me, I know modern historians say, oh, it didn't happen, never happened, couldn't have happened. I believe it did, And it's one of the most remarkable stories that I ever tell. But I'm not going to tell you tonight. You got to come back next week. Okay? So that's the Grecian Empire. Folks, I wish I had time for questions. I hope I made it as simple as possible. It's not a lot of Bible study, but next week we're going to be looking at the Grecian Empire. God bless you. You're dismissed.